The Beat 102-103 Southeast Sports Star of the Month Award on Sports Beat Roundup.
After an incredible year in the green of Ireland, Tipperary's Aimee-Lee Murphy-Crowe was crowned our Beat Southeast Sports Star of the Year for 2019. The 24-year-old became the first ever player from the Northern Hemisphere to win the Top Try Scorer Award and also earned a place on the World Sevens Dream Team. 33 tries in 35 games tells its own story, and another special night for Murphy-Crowe at a beautiful set theatre.
The overall winner of the 2019 Southeast Sports Star Awards is Aimee-Lee Murphy-Crowe.
Yeah, I'm surprised, to be honest. There's so many good nominees out there, from the Wexford Loretto College, like, to the racket ball players, to I'm from Tip, so I'd be a big fan of the Tip Hurlers. But no, this is beyond. I'm so impressed, thanks very much. I get to put on the Ireland jersey a lot more than a lot of the people who play for their country. I get to play 6 games each tournament, and I play 8 games. So every time I get to put on that jersey, it's not just my team or our staff, as I said, like, it's all the people of our country, and you just want to make them so proud of what you're doing, and you just want to cherish those moments for those people who are your supporters, who are back home, who might not even have a chance to ever play for Ireland. Like the Michelle, the ref, like, she went on to referee the game. Like, I'm so lucky that I actually get to play for my country and just keep making the country proud. We're in the middle of prep at the moment. We are playing the French today and tomorrow, and then we head to New Zealand next Friday, the 17th of January. So we play there the following weekend, so we'll acclimatise because it's really cold here. And then we'll play there, hopefully do our country proud again, and then we'll head to Sydney and play another tournament. So that's back to back alongside the men, which is very good for us, because it just shows what, if the men can do it, so can the women. Like, just like the referee, like, you just show the world that it's you. Yeah, exactly, girl power. Like, you just want to.
Tracking sport across the southeast.
Sports Beat Roundup.
Ken Doherty was our special guest, and his 20-minute Q&A with Beat's Vincent Bradley had the audience in the Marble City on tenterhooks, a city the former world champion knows intimately.
Definitely not my first time. I've been coming here for many, many years. In fact, I played, the last time I was here, I played an exhibition in the big room next door here against Ronnie O'Sullivan. That's probably going back 10 or 12 years ago. But I've been coming to Kilkenny for many, many years, you know, and it was Ronnie O'Sullivan. I mean, people would always talk about Ronnie O'Sullivan. He's the greatest player that ever lived. Well, I'm not boasting, but when I went to England first, I used to practice with him every day. And I used to beat him 10-2, 10-3. Now, he was only 12 at the time, but it still counts in my book. But yeah, I played him an exhibition in here. I've been coming to, you know, Kilkenny for years with Jimmy White and Steve Davis as well. So I've always had fantastic nights here in Langdon's. And there's always been, as you said, like, some great snooker players. Davy Morris, I've been on tour with him. You know, Rodney Goggins has been a fantastic player and played for Ireland many, many times. PJ Nolan, you mentioned. Even Eugene Hughes, who won the World Cup with Alex Higgins and Dennis Taylor in the 80s. He had a snooker club here in Kilkenny for many years. So, yeah, it's always been a great hotbed. And, you know, produced some great players over the years.
Going back to the start, as Gabrielle mentioned in your intro, I suppose Jason's is where it all kind of, that was your formative years. It almost took on a bit of a mystique, that club. It became the most famous sports club in the country for a while on the back of your success. What about those years? What was that like in Jason's at the time?
Well, like, I started going into Jason's when I was about 10 years of age. I first saw snooker on the TV back in when it was Pop Black, and I don't know where a lot of you would remember Pop Black back in the, I'm going back to like the 1970s. I was only about 8, and that was the first time I saw snooker. It was on the TV, and Alex Higgins was playing, and it was very funny because the commentator, we had a black and white TV at the time, and the commentator, believe it or not, said this live on TV, a fella called Ted Lowe, and he was whispering Ted Lowe, and he said, for those of you watching in black and white, the brown is next to the blue. So, but I thought he was talking about us because we had a black and white TV. But I saw Alex Higgins play on TV, and he was running around the table. He was potting balls. He was sort of he was Irish, of course, from Belfast, and he was very charismatic and totally against the grain of all the other snooker players, like Steve Davis at the time. He was very prim and proper and very different personalities. And because I saw that, I wanted to play snooker, you know, and I asked Santa for a little snooker table for Christmas, and lo and behold, it was at the bottom of my bunk bed on that Christmas, and that would have been about 1978. But Jason's was a snooker club in our area, so I used to get my brother to take me in there only on Sundays, and then when I got a little bit older, I used to go in like every day, throw the school bag under the table. I used to like empty the ashtray, sweep up, and I'd get a free game of snooker. Yeah. And like back in those days, you know, I used to have to, you know, stand on a little biscuit tin here or a little box here. And it reminded me of actually when I used to have to stand on the biscuit, because the snooker tables are quite long, like 12 foot by 6 foot. So I used to have to stand on a little, like Jacob's biscuit tin. And I'd kick it around the table, stand on it, and play the shot. And when I start beating all the older guys, they start hiding the biscuit in on me. So it was a lot more difficult to play. Like, going back to Jason's, the funny story was when I picked up my first cue there, because I'd be in there almost every day after school, and I didn't have a cue at the time. And I used to know all the sort of house cues. So you try and get in there and get the best cue. I didn't have a cue. But I found this cue that was on the pill rack. Somebody had put it back, and it wasn't a house cue. Somebody had actually been playing with it and left it behind. And I started to play with it, and I loved it. And I asked the manager, I says, can I keep this cue if nobody comes back? And I was only about 10 at the time. And the manager said, like in his broad Dublin accent, well, if you give us a fiver for it, you can keep it, you know. Now, I was only 10 at the time. So I ran around to my mother. I says, look, Mom, I said, I'll do some odd jobs and some summer jobs, and I'll give you the money back. And anyway, she eventually gave me the fiver. I went into the post office, which was right next to Jason's in Renly, and I changed the fiver into 5 old pound notes, went back into Jason's, put £3 in this pocket and £2 in this pocket, and I went back up to the manager and put the hand in this pocket, took the £2 out, and I said, look, my mother didn't have a fiver. I says, will £2 do you? So he looked at the cue, looked at the £2, and he says, give us the bleeding £2, you know? And I've had that cue, and it's the only cue, and he's talked about the warped cue, but it is a little bit warped in the middle. But I've had that cue since I was 10, and everything I've won, from the World Junior Championship to World Amateur Championship, World Professional Championship, with a £2 cue. So it was quite a good investment. And it's a little bit warped as well. You can imagine what I could have done if I had a straight cue, huh? That's my excuse. I was living, when I sort of finished school. So I wanted to finish school first. So I did my leaving, and then I sort of made the decision. I said, well, look, I've sort of been amateur champion here. So I thought I had to go to England, because that's where all the best players were, and that's where all the competitions every weekend. It was like pro-ams for amateurs. So I thought the only way I was going to improve or to try and get onto the professional circuit was to go away and to make the sacrifice. And I went over there with a couple of other Dublin lads who had the same idea to try and turn professional. And we went over on the boat, and I had £500 in my pocket. That was all I had to my name. And this was back in just after I left school in 1988. And I went over. I mean, £500, you'd probably spend this at a weekend here in Langdon's, wouldn't you, over a weekend? So I went. That was all the money I had in my life. And I went over there. I was staying in a friend's house, and I was getting free practice in a snooker club over there, which was okay. But we had to travel from one end of London to the other. We were staying in the West End, where Three Digs, where the snooker club where I was getting free practice was over in the east side of London, and it was 36 stops on the tube, and then 2 buses from the tube station to the snooker club, and then back again every day. Which geographically wasn't a very, very good idea, even though it was free lodgings. But that's how I started off, you know, and that's how I went over there. And but luckily I used to like bum lifts and say, you know, some of the guys in the student club would give you a lift with their father to pro-ams. And sometimes I'd end up winning the pro-am, but the guy who gave me the lift used to have to stay and wait for me to take me back. So nobody would give me lifts anymore, you know, so you had to make your own way. But I managed to live as an amateur, playing in pro-ams and just going up and down the country on trains, you know, buses, getting lifts, just to try and, you know, improve your game and try and get on the professional circuit. And then in 1989, I ended up winning the World Amateur Championship, and that got me onto the professional circuit.
And it didn't take you long to find your feet either. A couple of seasons in, you were already, you know, making top 10 in the rankings and starting to go deep in competitions. And a first ranking title is always the one you're looking for. You're wanting to win titles. Yeah. And the Welsh Open was the one for you. That must have been very sweet.
Yeah, it was. I beat another fellow professional and, of course, fellow commentator now, Alan McManus. I mean, that was in 1993, was my first Welsh Open. And I beat him 9-7. And we started touring pro around the same time, so Alan McManus, Peter Ebden, myself, Stephen Hendry had turned pro about 4 or 5 years before me. Ronnie O'Sullivan, John Higgins and Mark Williams, they came in 1992. They're sort of known as the class of 92 because they dominated, like, you know, the late 90s and then, of course, the 2000s. They won so many ranking tournaments between them. So there was quite a lot of really good players, young players that sort of come into the game. Whereas the game, like in the 80s and the 70s, there was a lot of older players, like in the 40s and late 30s, who were sort of dominating the game. So we were sort of the new breed, basically. But it was a good time because snooker had sort of moved on. Stephen Hendry had sort of dominated the 90s with so many world championship wins. But he brought a sort of a new perspective to the game, much more of an aggressive approach. Whereas like the older approach of Steve Davis and Dennis Taylor and players like that, they were a little bit more methodical in their approach of how they played. So we sort of followed the Stephen Hendry approach and tried to be a little bit more aggressive. And it's progressed on, and then the likes of Ronnie O'Sullivan and John Higgins and Mark Williams took the game on. But it was a great era to play in, you know, and winning your first ranking tournament is a big thing, of course.
Let's talk about 1997 then, just a few years later. You'd been in the top 10s, as I say, but coming into 1997, you were under a little bit of pressure, weren't you, for rankings? So you weren't, winning it wasn't your first objective coming into 1997.
No, I mean, my first match, I'll never forget it, it was a guy called Mark Davis, and I had a horrendous like run up to the World Championship. Steve Davis beat me here in Goffs, 6-1. He beat me in the Masters, which is going to take place next week. He beat me 6-1 there as well. I'd lost in the first round of the British Open to a fellow Dubliner, Michael George. So I was struggling to stay in the top 16. And my first match was against a guy called Mark Davis. So I wasn't thinking about the World Championship at all. I was thinking about winning that first match, because if I lost that first match, I was out of the top 16, which meant that you have to go and pre-qualify for every tournament. So it was such a big match for me. And when I won that match, it was amazing how things unfolded. It was a big weight off my shoulders. I was guaranteed a top 16 spot. I played Steve Davis in the second round, who had beaten me twice very, very badly. But I was a different player. You know, I played with a carefree attitude, and I ended up beating him 13-3. It was the only time that he'd been beaten with a session to spare. So for me, beating him, and then it going on, beat John Higgins in the quarterfinals, yeah. Elaine Robidoux in the semis, and then Stephen Hendry, I was playing in the final. But, you know, I don't know where, you know, people talk about visualization, you know, in sport. And it's a very interesting sort of topic, because I dreamt about winning the World Championship. When I sort of got to the final, I sort of dreamt every night, like I was dreaming about, I could see myself, because I'd watch Alex Higgins win it in 82. I'd watched Dennis Taylor win it in 85. And I could see myself, I sort of dreamt myself and sort of got myself into this sort of mode where I could see myself picking up that trophy, you know. So it didn't matter, even though I was playing the greatest player that ever lived, Stephen Hendry, I could see myself, and I sort of was trying to convince myself that I was going to win the cup. And it was amazing effect that it had on me. It gave me such a relaxing effect in the final that I just went out and played. And it didn't really matter whether it was Stephen Hendry there or Steve Davis or John Higgins. It didn't matter. And it's a great tool if you can use it. Unfortunately, it didn't happen to me after the World Championship, and I wish I could get it back a lot more often. But playing Stephen Hendry, I just felt fantastic. Yeah. And I went out and I played with a smile on my face and played very relaxed. And I think that sort of, in a way, Stephen Hendry was taken aback by that, because nobody had ever been like that against him. And he sort of said, well, this guy, he sort of enjoyed himself too. This is not right, you know, because normally he'd intimidate players. Yeah. But I wasn't intimidated by him and won. When I came back home, you know, with the cup and stuff like that, the open top bus and all through this, you know, it was stuff of dreams, like from the airport. It was thousands at the airport, back through Dublin, the open top bus. And then we had this reception at the Mansion House that the Lord Mayor threw. And when I was at the Mansion House, the chief superintendent from the Central Police Station in Dublin came up to me and says, "Can I tell you a funny story?" You know, he says, "You know that from the final," he said, "on Monday night," he said, "between the hours of 7 and 10, when you were playing," he said, "we didn't have one phone call into the Central Police Station in Dublin." And I said, "You're joking." He says, "Yeah." He says, "Normally we have a phone call every 5 minutes, you know." And the girls in the switchboard in Harcourt Street rang the main telecom switchboard saying, "Is there something wrong with our phones? Because we haven't had any phone calls yet." And the woman at the other end of the line, "Are you not watching the bleeding snooker?" She says, "The whole country is watching it." And the chief superintendent said to me, he said, "Doherty," he says, "you should be on television more often." He said, "Do you make my job a hell of a lot easier?"
We're going to see, I'm sure, over the coming days with the Masters getting underway.
Yeah, the Masters starts on Sunday.
Mm. Ronnie is not playing. What do you make of that?
Strange decision, to be honest, you know. I think Ronnie...
I don't think even Ronnie can figure Ronnie out.
You know, he's one of those enigmas, you know, and he's a genius snooker player. Mm. There's no doubt about that. I mean, he made a 147. It's our toughest break to make, like 36 shots in like 5 minutes and 20 seconds. I mean, it used to
the take, same year you used won to the
take,
championship.
Used to take Peter Ebdon that just to break off, like, you know. So it's quite he's a genius player, but he's such a complex character, you know.
Does the sport need those characters though?
Sorry,
does the sport need a character like that? Back in, I mean, you talk about the '80s and the Steve Davis, Dennis Taylors. They were household names. Ronnie,
oh, without a doubt, yeah.
If you're not into snooker, there's a danger that Ronnie may well be one of the only household names.
Well, yeah, you'd say that, but I think the game has still got a lot of characters. Mm-hmm. You know, Judd Trump is a great character. He won the World Championship this year. And he's a great young talent as well. Neil Robertson, you know, Selby. There's lots of great players in the game. Yeah. I think sometimes Ronnie can get a bit caught up that he thinks he's bigger than the game, and nobody is bigger than any sport,
sure.
Believe me, no matter what sport you're in, the sport always survives, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
Beat Roundup on Beat 102-103.
Meanwhile, the winner of the public vote was Waterford's under-19 side after they captured the Elite League title after beating Galway United at Terryland Park. Manager Gary Hunt said the ceremony was particularly special for his side.
It's been a fantastic evening. Sitting there among so many people who've experienced success over the last 12 months is inspirational in itself. And to see the different sports recognised here, I think something that stands out really well. To recognise the sports maybe that people aren't as much aware of, I think that's really good. That because, you know, you have kids out there that could be the next world champions in a sport that they might not have access to other than Beat maybe promoting them, you know.
A sentiment echoed by racquetball players Ken Cottrell and Mark Murphy, winners of our September award.
It gives every kind of a sport an opportunity to win. Absolutely. It's brilliant for racquetball because racquetball will be a very minority sport, so we're delighted to be up here for an award.
Sports Beat Roundup on Beat 102-103.
That's all for this week's Sports Beat Roundup Southeast Sports Star Special. Kevin's back with a regular show next week, but Trish has the soundtrack now for your Saturday night. She's up next with Beat Anthems.